Welcome to the Yokoji Zen Mountain Center podcast. Every month we share at least one new talk on the practice of Zen Buddhism at cmc.org/podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and all other podcast apps. If you find these talks to be valuable, please consider supporting Yokoji by donating at cmc.org/donate. We rely on your support to continue sharing this life-changing practice. Thank you. We hope you enjoy the talk.
Good morning. Happy Thanksgiving. Yeah, it's plenty to be thankful for. Huh? We're all alive and kicking, which is good. So today I wanted to talk about the Buddha's original statement, all beings are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness, but because of our upside down views, we fail to see it. We talk about Buddhism, we talk about Zen, we talk about all kinds of religions, and ultimately it comes down to this moment in time. But maybe more important than that is our relationship to it. Quite often, it's like, yeah, I've got to practice this thing so that these things will happen. But it's very difficult for us to actually swallow our own existence, the whole existence of living a whole. You know, usually we place our own criteria on it, you know, like when I will become what I have, what I haven't, our lives in comparison with other people's lives. All the criteria that we add over the top tend to get us confused about what our life is. The old teachers, they tend to, you know, tell us that basically everything's okay. Or, you know, so that's the first thing, that intrinsic part, everything's okay. You know, why make any more work than the life that you already are living? And then others are more concerned with method, you know. So many people will get confused over those two things that seem to be juxtaposed to one another. Ultimately, in our own life, it comes down, you know, is that, are you satisfied with the life that you have? You know, is this okay? I mean, if you're satisfied, there's not an awful lot of work that needs to be done. No matter, you know, how deep or shallow you feel your understanding is, you know, if you feel that this is complete, then there's not an awful lot to be taken care of. And you can appreciate the life that you have. It doesn't matter about the whole Tripitaka, all of the Buddha's teachings, all of the Zen teachings. They really don't mean an awful lot because they're just additions or descriptions of the life that we have, or movement towards the life that we already have at this point in time. This morning, I was thinking about this, and I was looking at a koan to sort of illustrate it. Because it gives us, you know, a slightly different sort of perspective on life. So this is from the Gateless Gate. It's in Japanese, so it says Gateless Gate, by Yamada Roshi. And this is case 9. It's called Daitsu Chisho. Once a monk earnestly asked priest Joe of Koyo, Daitsu Chisho Buddha, sat in the meditation hall for 10 kalpas. But the Dharma of the Buddha did not manifest itself, and he could not attain Buddhahood. Why was this? Joe replied, "Your question is reasonable indeed." Could have left it at that. The monk said, "He sat in Zazen in the meditation hall. Why did he not attain Buddhahood?" And Joe replied, "Because he is a non-attained Buddha." Munwan's commentary: I approve the old barbarian's realization, but I do not approve the old barbarian's understanding. When an ordinary person has realized it, he is a saint. If a saint understands it, he is nothing but an ordinary person. The verse, far better than realizing the body is to realize the mind and be at peace. If the mind is realized, there is no anxiety about the body. If the body and mind are completely realized, a holy hermit does not wish to be appointed Lord. So, you know, in many ways, koan like this is complicating things. But for some reason, as human beings, we feel somewhat comforted by people reassuring us about our own life, our own existence. I mean, just listen to all the religious teachers, you know, whatever religion they're from, you know, they, you know, God loves you. All you have to do is live a moral life. This goes across the board, you know, in Buddhism, you know, you are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness. But the questions really arise around what to do with it. And again, just this aspect of satisfaction. It took the Buddha 6 years to sort of clear away the dust of his own approaches to life and go beyond the approaches of the people of his day. And you have to remember that that's very important, that 6 years of his life, where he basically tried everything that was available to him to bring his own mind at peace. Some of us can be brought to peace fairly straightforwardly and easily. Others, it takes, we have very active brains, thought processes that extrapolate and tend to run the show, so that it's very difficult to actually accept what's occurring on a momentary basis. When I say accept, I mean just the reality of this, that life is like this, it occurs like this. That's where the work really needs to be done. I remember at the time when the EST organization was really, really popular and people were coming out with the cliche of, you know, have you got it yet? You know, and people that had been through the workshops would say, yes, I've got it. You know, and I went through the workshops and no, I haven't got it. And people would ask me that. No, I haven't got it. Why? Because there's nothing to get. You know, that was from my perspective. It wasn't a matter of becoming something else or getting something that would change my life in a definitive way. You know, it's that the main thing was I was missing the life that was occurring on a momentary basis. When you know, when people would ask me about the Zen approach, is that when I started and for the first few years, is I would say, you know, meditation basically is what makes me feel at home, because basically I wasn't putting reliance on thought. At those times, I didn't know an awful lot about Zen or Buddhism. It's just that when I sat, then the thought process would tend to settle down and being would come to the surface. And really, that's what the whole process of Zen is around. It's a switch from a thought-based system to an experience-based system. Now, this is maybe the key of the whole of practice, is that for many people, they may study for 40, 50 years, but they have so much trust in the thought process that we can work out what this world is, what this universe is, what peace is. But unfortunately, it really doesn't work. That's where the attention really has to come. That's why concentration is the basis of the Buddhist tradition in general. If in doubt, return to concentration. What is it? It's not concentration on something else. It's concentration on being and allowing all of your energies to be in this place. And if you do that for enough time, is that then thought tends to fall into its right place as one of the six senses, not the one that runs it, not the one that's trying to work out this universe. Now, in that process, you see that the head, this thing here, can never realize everything else. It's way too big. Everything else is way too big. That's the biggest part of our experience. I remember when I was living in the Godo in LA, one morning I woke up and I went, you know, I'll never be able to work this out. But it wasn't a loser type mentality. It was a relief. It's like, I can never work out this world, but I can experience it to whatever depth I can experience it. And nobody has a depthometer there. So at that point, then it allowed me, rather than always wherever I was trying to work things out, I try to experience it out, try to feel it out, and then work in this world in that way. And again, that is really the definitive shift in Buddhism. You can say, well, it's about realization, but realization of what? It's a realization of this. That's what the Buddha saw. It wasn't like he saw this amazing morning star. No, he saw the same star that we see today, as far as we know. They reckon it was Venus, you know. Again, when you look at Venus, what do you see? And that's I'm just asking you in that way. Yeah, it's just another star, you know, or it's out early this morning or whatever. You know, there's a description that goes around it. But when you really experience something thoroughly, it strikes you very deeply. And that is the momentary practice that we do as human beings, is that be here and be here, and then things begin to strike you deeply. And just like I remember Akiba Roshi saying, when people do session or intensive retreats, they look more beautiful. You know, I mean, I don't do session for that, but it just happens to be true. People tend to relax. They tend to, you know, not be putting their attention on worrying about all the kind of things that could occur later on. Now, so we're left, you know, I wouldn't say it's a dichotomy, but, you know, in our minds, we tend to hold one thing up and then the other one's in shadow. So we have these two things. We have this aspect that, yeah, you know, the Buddha says we are complete, whole, as we are. We have the wisdom, we have the virtue. In other words, the being in itself, appreciate it right there. And then we have the methods that move us to it. So in this particular case that I brought up, and I'm using as an illustration, the monks going, well, this Daisu Chisho Buddha sat in the meditation hall for, you know, 10 kalpas. I mean, for me, anything over a week is a long time, you know. So like a kalpa, you know, it's the amount of time that an angel comes down once every 100 years, brushes a plateau a mile cubed, and then flies off back to heaven. It's the amount of time it takes to wear that down. So it doesn't even really bear the amount of thinking that it's just basically a long time. So Daitsu Chisho Buddha, in other words, I actually read what his name meant today, which is the first time. So this gives you a kind of a clue to it, which is the Chisho part means penetrating wisdom. And the Daitsu means basically penetrating everywhere at all times. So with that kind of name, basically, and if it's a truth, then what is he going to attain? Because already there is everywhere in every, you know, every time. And that's the wisdom, is realizing that we have that. Now, if you sit, whether you walk, whether you work, whether you are talking with someone, you're having an argument, you're enjoying something, every sphere of human activity is contained in that name. So it's no wonder he doesn't attain something, because there is no need to attain something else, because there isn't anything else that can be attained at that point. And, you know, I was also looking at Yamada Roshi's commentaries on this, and this is one of the problems about a religion coming from another country. A third of his talk on this is involved in translation, you know. So don't worry about the translation. Just feel that in your own bones. You have this already. Already, you know, you can see, you know, to a huge extent. I mean, you see stars that are light years away. How far can you see? Basically, you can't put a boundary on it. We don't know how far we see. It's incredibly far. We feel things through the planet, you know, earthquakes that are miles away, you know. We smell things from, you know, from the ocean, from vast areas away, fires, incense, all kinds of stuff that's coming in. These are our senses that are vast and boundless already. We can't really put a limit on them. You know, people always try to do that. I was laughing the other day. Somebody was telling me, well, you know, about the brain, and now scientists have agreed that in meditation, this is what occurs. I said, I don't need verification from the scientists. I feel that in my bones, you know, but we always want something objective to tell us about what we already are, and some proof or some validation from externals, when there really are no externals in the sense that we already contain all of that in our sense sphere. Never do we wake up in the morning without the world there. You know, if we think we're so, you know, isolated, alone, or et cetera, is that these things are really not true. The world is practicing with us 24/7. I'm not saying it practices Buddhism. There's no need for that. Not practicing Zen, it's practicing being exactly as is. That is the teaching that we get. Moment by moment, the earth is always bearing witness to us, as the sutras say. You know, the earth bore witness to the Buddha's enlightenment. You know, these things bore witness. Everything bears witness to our own activities and actions, and the same in reverse. That's always going on. We're never separate than our environment, whether it be the mountains, the city, the ocean, the sky. You know, no matter where we are, that is constantly going along with us. Now, it's kind of interesting when, say, in this particular case koan, it says something from Mumon's commentary. Where are we? Far better than realizing the body is to realize the mind and be at peace. Now, usually when we look at this, again, is that we look at mind as thought processes, but that really needs to be clarified in our own, you know, in our own experience, because when we talk about mind, it is the whole shebang. It's not just the thought process, but we as humans value thought that much that we put it as, well, you know, it's the thought process. But when we really look at it, is that, I mean, look around you now, how much is coming in through the eyes. You know, hear, and then feel how much is coming through the ears. You know, and again, with each of the senses, you can explore that and really see. This is mind. It's got all of this. And that includes the object, the vehicle, the subject. And then the thought process is only a small part of it, but we value it that much that we put it out there, you know, and it's ridiculous. And that's what he says, far better than to realize the body is to realize the mind. In realizing the mind is making real the mind that we are, all of this that's coming in. Then there is no place to go. Even though we go to all these different places, it is still the mind. Everything is included in that. But again, it's that real shift that we need to make as human beings that stops us feeling alienated and separate from the world around us. Wherever we are, you know, penetrate directly into our environment. It's always there. We learn vicariously all the time through all kinds of things and how they function, and allow that to occur. That's basically, you know, what the Buddha's saying in that second part. But because of our upside down thoughts or views, we fail to see it. We try and put forward our manifesto of how the world should work, how it has worked, and how it's worked for others in comparison. You wipe away all of these things, and you see this basic being And none of that can reach the being that we are, again, on a momentary basis. You can say it's vast and boundless in that way. That's somewhat of a cliche, but it's not really made small. Always, again, the universe, the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, the people, they're all moving and practicing forward as our lives on a momentary basis. Now, this monk is really getting upset with Priest Jojo, and he goes, yeah, your question's, he says, your question's well put, you know. And I like that because he goes, yeah, it's a good question. But so really, it's up to you. Nobody else can really answer that for you. That's the whole quest of putting one's mind to rest. If you don't do it for yourself, nobody's words are really ever going to satisfy you. Because the Buddha says it in his first statement of realization. But then he continued to say, you know, make music on the same theme for his entire life. Variations on that same thing. All beings have the wisdom or are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness. But it's really up to us to swallow it as individuals. That's where the work really comes in. Now, this monk, of course, you know, he really values meditation very, very strongly. And I'm sure that each one of us do at various phases in our own practice. You know, I can say, yeah, you know, the world is like this, etc. But for me to get to this point, I really had to wear out a lot of that thought process. Well, it can't be this. It's got to be more. There's got to be deeper understandings. There's got to be, you know, it's got to fit into, say, the old master's teachings. It's got to fit into the Buddha's teachings. But my life never has done that. It's always spill over. You know, whenever you read writings of somebody's teachings, is that that's going in a certain direction. But most of life is never going in a single direction. Stuff's always coming in from the outside, whether it be people, whether it be things. And we respond to those. Our practice is never linear. So in that process, at some point, which is what the meditation really is about, it's not just while I'm meditating, I'm getting good feelings on this, I'm entering into deep samadhi, all of those things. It's not what is this? And then eventually is that all of these things that we add as extras are cut through. Now, if you're not doing that in meditation is a waste of time. If it's just about sitting there and feeling good about things, you've got to cut through that, or else never will its true power be really revealed. You know, when you can sit there as thisness, that's when meditation is really working in that way. And its job is to cut through all illusions. That is what true wisdom is. It's no, that's an illusion. Drop it. That's why Dogen, you know, in all of his teachings, emphasizes practice realization. It's not the realization that we've had or is coming. It's this realization, you know. This realization that's going on now. And this realization is never in comparison with anything else. That's just a mental formation. It's just something that we put there in our own heads. At some point, we really have to swallow this whole, our own life. This is the way my life is. Whether it be happy, sad, painful, pleasurable, any of these things, you know, now, how do I work with this? This is where the creativity comes in. Now, you might notice somebody like the Buddha, he spent, you know, 40 years teaching. And as his teachings worked or didn't work, they evolved, just like our lives evolved to fit with our own environment. Now, if our lives are based around taking everything back to this moment in time, starting from this, then whatever construction we do in terms of our own existence can be amazing. It can really be based on something that is solid in that way. And then being flexible enough to deal with all kinds of changes that occur in our own lives. That's that aspect of impermanence. You know, when you know basically what your life is, who you are as a human being, is that then you can be very flexible in who you're doing and what's going on. It's not, you know, well, you've got this really good life there, you know, how can I do these things that you're doing? None of this is all bullshit. The main thing is how do you deal with the ingredients of your own existence at any given time. You know, and that's where we really encourage others. It's not that we're, say, obeying the rules of Buddhism. No, we're really dealing with that basic thing of what's going on here. How is my life? Can I live with this decision? You know, is this going to really be a benefit, or is it just a short-term fix that I'm going to have to come back to later? So, you know, with this Daitsu Chisho, yeah, he sat in the Buddha hall for, you know, a long time, and he didn't attain realization. Now, again, you know, in terms of our own society, this is a very, very important thing for most people, is to attain something or to become something, you know. And then what do we do if we don't become that? I mean, we just had 4 years of that where, you know, oh, I can't become this, you know, and I don't have that, nor you're a loser, etc. But how does that affect your basic being as a human being? Now, this Daitsu Chisho sat in the Buddha hall or in the Zendo for, you know, a long time, didn't become a Buddha. Did that affect him? I mean, basically, we should be asking him. Not this other guy or Priest Jojo, is that maybe he didn't need to attain anything. Why? Because there was an appreciation there for the life that he already had. Why do you need to be something else? Why do you have to become something else? Some of the best examples that I've come across in terms of living of people, you know, this is who I am and I've done the best that I possibly can with life. It couldn't be another way. Why? Because it isn't. You know, I've done the best that I possibly can. There's no regrets in that kind of thing. It's not, well, I can't do this because these rules tell me to do this. It's no, I have done this for the betterment of my society, the betterment of the people around me. And it hasn't worked out. So I'm going to apologize for this and move on from that. It's where people really take responsibility in that way for their own life and the life of the people around them. It extends. And those waves continue. That's why the Buddha's teachings is so valuable today, is that he took responsibility for what he did. And the power of that stance and that approach is still powerful today. After 2,500 years. It's not that he did everything right. He made mistakes. Apparently, he gave a talk about the emptiness of all things, and apparently 300 people committed suicide. So he never talked about that again in that way. He did something different. You know, it's just that must have been a very difficult thing. Look at people like Martin Luther. He saw the corruption of the Catholic Church back in the 15th century, something like that, 15th, 16th century. His actions caused over 100,000 people to die. And then religious warfare for maybe 100 years. But in his own heart and mind, he felt it was the best thing to revitalize the church at that point. What an amazing thing. That's one of the reasons that he was remembered. We can argue about whether that was worthwhile or not. But when religion dies or is corrupt, it has a negative effect on all of us. You go back to the teachings of Christ, for instance. What did he teach? Love, appreciation, love for different nations and approaches to live in. You know, the love of God, we might say the love of Buddha nature in that way. Those are basic needs that we have as human beings, or love for the thing that is non-fixed, that embraces us 24/7. You know, go back to those basics, and all religion really has to do that over and over and over. That's why the Zen school came forward. It was not about you go through 52 stages of enlightenment, or you become a monk, or you do these things. No, it's just about how do we live now? What really benefits us as human beings? How do we deal with the suffering that we have as human beings? Now, if we go back to the Buddha's first teachings, where he talked about the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. He came back to that basic aspect of being. So what do you do once you realize that you're being? Is that then maybe you deal with the suffering. Not put another veneer on, well, I'm doing these practices over the top. But how do I deal with that? The first thing is to look at how suffering arises in ourselves. Experience that. It's not just, well, I'm going to get rid of these things. No, see how they operate first. So again, it's like being in a car. You know, again, that suffering apparently in Sanskrit was, the Buddha said after his enlightenment, this one here is a stuck axle wheel. And that's a very important thing to realize. He said that after enlightenment, it's not now I am enlightened, these mechanics no longer work. It's like, no, you get into a car, for instance, and the wheels aren't turning. So, you know, you can get and go, oh, yeah, the wheels aren't turning, which is to just accept suffering as it is, you know, not do anything about it. Carry on with the same old things that are going on. He goes, no, the wheels are not turning. Okay. Now, most of us wouldn't stay there. You know, we kind of go, okay, have I turned it on? You know, so then, yeah, you turn it on and then, you know, you're still not going. The wheels are not going, you know. You can rock back and forth. You can try various things, you know, but it may not work. And then, okay, maybe put it into gear. Okay. But this is inquiry. This is how inquiry works. This is koan. It doesn't have to be in so-called koan study. It's looking into the nature of which is going on. Then maybe take the break off, you know, and then if it's still not going, then, you know, have a look outside and see if there's a rock under the wheel, you know. So that this is the gathering of information, which is all part of the meditative process. And in that process, if you see something, then it's important to act on it. Once you get that information, then it's important to act. And then experiment with it. And it doesn't have to be in accord with your society or the fact that, say, I'm doing Shikantaza or I'm doing koan study. Is do whatever is necessary. Again, that is true koan. That's bringing things into balance in terms of one's own life. Insight and then functioning. Those are very important. So with this process, yeah. So this is what the Buddha Daitsu Chisho was doing, being in that meditation hall. Like the Buddha, this one here is a stuck axle wheel. Does it just end with Daitsu Chisho? Or he was probably sitting with other people in a zendo. Now, is he just doing that for himself? Or Is he doing this because he knows himself and the people around him are not two different things? You know, we have to remember is the Buddha could have quit when he was enlightened. Seriously, you know, that went across his mind apparently. You know, he's going, I don't think people could understand this. Okay, that's the wheel. It's stuck. It's stuck. Okay, yeah, I'm done. I'm going off. I'm going off back to my wife and kids, trying to reconstruct my country, you know. But practice would have still gone on in that respect. No, it's like, I will make the attempt, whether it's successful or not. Now, you could say this is Thanksgiving, true Thanksgiving. He realized something and he wanted to share it. He realized the wonder of it and he appreciated it. He raised the value of his momentary existence up to the surface and then gave thanks for it. And how did he do that? He was just trying to show people that this is possible. And in that process, then people think, well, he's making that effort, so I might as well do that. You know, I've told the stories of Maizumi Roshi. You know, is when I was his attendant, I would go in. This is probably about 10 years before he died. He was already tired at that point, you know. And I remember waking him up probably about half an hour, 40 minutes before Zazen started. And, right, Roshi, wake up, tea's downstairs. And then I went back downstairs, you know, just to get it ready, pour it out. Still no show. After about 5 or 10 minutes, went back up and he was fast asleep. Woke him up again. And, you know, he goes, Roshi, tea's ready. And then, so I went up a third time, you know, cut a short, long story short, and said, Roshi, why don't you just lie in? You're exhausted. And he goes, no, I'll get up. I said, why'd you, you know, a very sort of normal question. Why'd you do this? You know, why'd you do this? Get some rest. He goes, I do it because you do it. It meant something to me, you know. I mean, it's partially a joke. I do it because you do it, because he had a bit of that in his voice. But the other thing was, no, you know, we're in this together. If people didn't show up at the Buddha Hall, I certainly wouldn't. You know, if anything, I might sit here. But there's that aspect. We're in it together. That's so important. People now are all talking about, well, there's no community left. Community is showing up. I don't mean just in Zazen, but with people and connections wherever you can, Zoom wherever you can. It's making that attempt. And then you know, then community can actually survive. So Daitsu Chisho, he recognizes, there's nothing to attain here, but man, it has some amazing effects on our society. It doesn't just end up with me, and it's not that I'm spreading these things out. It's no, do it, and then it has effects. Those effects go across. Better to make that attempt than not to make the attempt. That's the story of those early years of Shakyamuni Buddha. When 40 years of returning that, you know, that's incredible. You know, and we get so wrapped up in, yeah, he had great realization. And all he said was, yeah, wonder of wonders, I, all beings, the great earth, are the wisdom and virtue. Now, are, right from the beginning, no matter whether you started or not. Just like the same in the ox herding pictures, is that the 10th picture is almost the same as the first picture, except you got somebody helping somebody else, who they recognize as, yeah, they're on the same path. They started this just like I started it. And we recognize that. We feel empathy for, you know. It's natural for us as human beings. Meditation is simply seeing directly into our nature. It doesn't have to be confined to sitting. But sitting is one of the most powerful tools you'll ever find in this planet. Because if you can sit there when nothing's going on and look into your nature, man, you can really do all kinds of things seeing into your nature. You know, because when you sit there, all the stuff that's buried comes up to the surface as well. And then you can deal with it. And then you can deal with it as you move, as you do various things, and not have it get in the way. Again, you know, going back to Shakyamuni Buddha, was no matter what's going on, no matter how chaotic the world is, come back to being. No matter where you are, that's what concentration is about. You see it with musicians, you see it with artists, you see it with soccer players, all kinds of players. They come back to just doing the basics. What are the basics? Being this, and then apply that to all things that occur sequentially. So I think I'll finish there. I've gone over by 10 minutes, but that's the way it goes. Timeless. Right, so if you have any questions or comments, please do.
Okay, you can now unmute yourselves. You can also use the raise hand feature. And I've opened up chat.
Jane.
Jane, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, Yokoji lovers.
Yeah.
I've been working through some psychosomatic chronic pain, and one thing I realized is that, you know, I have a lot of traumatic memories of my mother when she had cancer.
Yeah.
Come, and you know, it's very painful, and I realized that my central nervous system was like, you know,
freaking out.
And so I started to, you know, kind of just say to myself, like, okay, I'm here now and I'm safe now, and that's not happening anymore, to, you know, help my nervous system calm down a bit. And yet, and my question is around feelings. Because, like, so how do I, you know, not suppress what's there, but, also not dwell in that, you know, it's, I mean, it's part of the practice I'm doing, you know, letting thoughts and feelings come in and out, but, you know. I still feel like threatened by those painful traumatic memories, but I'm trying to shift my focus.
Yeah, I think part of it is, you know, don't take them as being bad. You know, they're not good either. You know, the thing is that when you're in it, study how it functions. It's like a teacher. It may not be pleasurable, but see how it functions. It's like with any form of PTSD. Is that basically it's important to acknowledge that's what you're going through first, rather than, you know, look, this is what it's going to look like when I'm through it. It's rather feel it. It'll have its season, then it passes. I mean, I was talking with Jokai about when we were going through the fire and floods that we had in 2013. As soon as we started talking about it, you could feel the trauma there coming up. I mean, now we can laugh at it on some levels, but it, you know, it's just recognizing that occurs when you've gone through difficult times. It's like with dealt with soldiers that have you know, been in the Iraq War and Vietnam War and stuff, and it's important to for them to actually get it out through talking it out. Otherwise, it stays stuck in there and you can't really get past it. So it's acknowledging, yeah, this was part of my life, and it begins to come out. And in time, it doesn't have the same grip over you had before. But it's not good or bad. It's just a fact. But we've got the archetype of the Buddha. You know, he was successful. He managed to get through all of these things. But we forget he was like us. You know, he had traumas as well that happened in his life. You know, I mean, we don't look at that. I mean, his own country was destroyed by his mother's country. And I'm sure he wasn't happy about it, you know, because he knew the people who were getting killed, etc. And I'm sure he had things like guilt about not being there for them to help them through it. And then his cousin tried to kill him four times, you know. You know, he wasn't like us, you know, I mean, he was maybe a little bit, you know, on a different spectrum in that way. He was very forgiving. I don't know if many of us could do that, but he went through difficulties too in terms of his own life and then migrating from one place to another simply because he couldn't put the pressure on the local populations to feed him, you know, like up to 300 people. But we have to examine the place that we're at. And then work with those ingredients. And in doing so, then we develop skills to help other people that go through similar things. So it's not an accident you're going through this. And if you go through it in a, you know, in a way that really looks into your nature and you get some relief in the midst of it, you'll be able to pass that on to other people. But I feel for you, you know, it's not easy. You know, it's like when my mother died, it was similar too. But as those stories come out, feel them, see what occurs, and it'll clear away a lot of the chaff, the stuff that's not that necessary, and you'll be able to put things into a different perspective. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane.
Ah. Okay. It's only one.
Bhushan.
Hi, Bhushi.
Hey.
Thank you.
Hey, Bhushan.
Hey. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that talk. That was great.
Oh, good.
A couple of things. One, when you were just talking about the fires with Jokai, immediately, I was drawn to the...
Well, that's another one. That's another story. Right. Yeah.
To the floods of last year.
Yeah.
And, going through that together. The everyone pulling together and just doing what needed to be done.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah. It helps.
And it was, for me, it was a really bonding experience.
Yeah, yeah.
With everyone there at the center.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also, what you said during your talk about community is showing up.
Yeah, yeah.
Showing up and being there. And I've been sitting on the beach here in Florida for months. 3 or 4 months, mm-hmm. and
so
for the first 3 months, every day I was alone for an hour. There was nobody.
Yeah.
And now by, miracle of miracles, there's people showing up, One day we had five people and there's more people, and I gave a talk this morning and,
It was great.
It was great.
But I mean, that's the root, that's the root of the word community. It's coming into one. It doesn't mean that's the way it is already, is coming together in that way. But quite often we don't make the effort. It's like communicate. I mean, first you have to find out how to get on the same page.
Yeah.
Coming into one, So there's gonna be some back and forth, positive and negative in that respect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also I'll just finish on this.
Yeah, interrupting you.
Zazen is just what you said about it being, I think you said it was a tool for looking directly at this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it's a fantastic tool for that. It's great.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. I mean, it even works as something to bring you peace. I was somewhat denigrating that aspect, just in sitting there and letting your energy settle too. But it's important to see what's there, no matter when or where. So that's where it becomes, such an amazing tool in that respect. And then that's where it's a koan. If something doesn't feel right, then that's the aspect of kind of bringing things, making unevenness into being even. So focusing on those things that are not even, and then it does that. Even if it doesn't get up to the level of intellect, you're doing that work of bringing yourself into balance with the world around you.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I mean, koan isn't something else. It is living in itself. That's what I'm doing when I live, is I'm bringing things into balance. And usually it's me that's out of balance with the rest of the world. That's where the work's got to be. It's not, I expect the world to follow what I'm doing. No, it never has, in that way. Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Good luck with the group, too. It's nice to hear. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Liam.
Can you unmute yourself, Liam?
Hi there.
Hi. Good seeing you.
See you again.
Yeah.
On that, it was a lovely talk and really rang. I had a great ring of
truth.
Seeing to it. It was lovely.
Yeah.
But there was a bit in there where you said about, or it was, I think it was in the comment about, and it reminded me of something which I heard, and I think it's the same thing. When an ordinary man acquires knowledge, he becomes a sage.
Yeah.
And when a sage acquires wisdom, he becomes an ordinary man. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Yeah, it says, when an ordinary person has realized it, he is a saint. When a saint understands it, he's nothing but an ordinary person. Yeah.
Yeah. So the wisdom, like, is an appreciation of the ordinariness, which is extraordinary.
Well, yeah, and part wisdom. And part of it is, you know, it's not that I have wisdom. You know, it's that the world is wise, and I'm not separate than that. Yeah. You know, it's not something overlaid over something else. That's right there. You know, it's just like the ceiling's up there, the floor's here. Fire gives out heat. The sun comes over that way and goes that way. There's nothing to look for. It's there, you know, in that respect. And it, you know, in this, I like it because then, you know, then a saint becomes an ordinary person. You don't need the label sainthood. You know, or to be something, I'm already this way. And then I think somewhere in there it also says that, you know, basically if you become a saint, gets in the way, because then people want you to do all kinds of stuff, you know, rather get on with your living in that respect. Yeah, a holy hermit does not wish to be appointed Lord. So when you have something, when you can function, is that you don't need the title. As I am, this is enough in this respect.
It seems to be, well, to me, it seems to have that ego attachment.
Yeah.
With being a sage, you know, I know this, yeah. I know that, I know. And a real attachment to having to know.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
Wisdom is just letting go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Living life. Yeah, and it is kind of interesting, you know, we tend to use that word ego in an incorrect way, you know, like it's almost like ego is a separate thing than who we are. Now, in therapy, as far as I know, is that ego is used as integrated self. So we don't use it very well in Buddhism. We kind of mainly use that around the disowned aspects of our own being, like, you know, greed, anger, ignorance, jealousy, revenge, all of those things. But if you actually look into your own nature and you look for this thing called ego, is that I'll see the arisings of greed. I'll see the arisings of anger. I'll see these things, but there's no continuity there with this thing called ego. These are just arisings. Now, if I can deal with them as they are, it's not like I have to set up this alter ego, this other part of me that is being disowned. It's just like, no, this is what's arising now. One of the problems is as we start saying this word ego, then we begin to, it's another part that's in the shadows that hasn't been examined, you know, that's going to come out and bite us at some point or go off on automatic. So that is part of who we are as human beings. You know, it's just like one of the statements that can be attributed to me is that we didn't get to the top of the food chain by being nice. So that's what we're dealing with. You know, we have to. That's a big part of Buddhist practice, is that I accept these parts in me. Now, how do I deal with them? And once I've got some insight into it here, then how can I deal with it out there? With people that are having those same aspects.
Makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, good. Yeah, well, by the way, you've got a really good picture in Ireland.
But the ego can kind of, you know, feel like a bit of an enemy. Whereas if you integrate it in, it's like, it's okay. It's not a...
Well, yeah, I mean, these are energies. I mean, even things like anger is that under certain circumstances where you want to prevent somebody else from attacking the people around you, you put up that facade. But as long as you know you can put up that facade and not be intimidated by it and have it come down again, it's a great tool. But that's where the work really needs to come in Buddhism, it's not like putting a veneer of peace over the top. You know, because that veneer is going to crack. You know, the fires of hell are going to come out through it. You know, sorry, I just had to do that. You know.
Very good. Can I just ask? So can I add one more thing?
Yeah,
I ask you,
please.
You know,
yeah.
In that saying, the wisdom and virtue. What can you just expand a little bit on what the virtue bit is?
Well, somebody told me about that. I mean, before I thought it was like all the things that you accumulated that were good, but I heard more that it's like the actual beingness of your own your own life, virtue in that way. Maizumi Roshi understood it more like all of the good things that you developed over your living. You know, but if you look at it in the dictionary, it'll give you a more accurate thing than I'm saying. But it's more like the intrinsic aspect of your being is your virtute, or whatever it was, the old Latin word. So I can understand it more from that perspective. Maizumi Roshi is going, well, it's not all how good you are, you know, on that level. And he would say, you know, you can forget the virtue and you can forget that aspect of, you know, of having attained all this stuff. Put that on one side and just really see the wisdom of your own being. But, you know, look in the dictionary and see, you know, be good. Yeah.
The dictionary is too linear. It's just,
yeah. No, but sometimes it gives me insight. You know, it's great, you know, on that level. Yeah. Q.
Anyway, thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Liam. Is that Bruce?
Yeah, Bruce. I'm assuming this is the Bruce Ingalls. Hello. Hey, Bruce. There you are. Good.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for bringing out that virtue.
Yeah.
I often, since I'm not in a Zen center right now, sometimes I think there's a lot of the old koans or whatever that I've heard that I've never totally processed, you know? So then,
yeah.
Yeah, they come up and they go, what does that really mean, you know? And that's one of them. That's nice, the virtue.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you, we have this intrinsic awareness.
Yeah.
And then everything happens in the awareness. Otherwise, we wouldn't be aware of it. And it would, if it was outside this awareness, we wouldn't even know about it.
Yeah.
And so when Dogen talks about the real human body, or when you talk about the vastness of life, I just want to make sure what you mean. What you mean is that because of this awareness, it's this whole thing.
Yeah, it includes everything. Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these simple things
that's
like...
That's something that you say a lot.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I do, because a lot of people don't get it, you know. But it's like, you know, if somebody's in the room with you and they're at the other side of the room, you're not even touching them, and they cut themselves, it's like, you know, you feel it. We're connected in ways that we don't even acknowledge. It's not, that's outside. This is where the body ends, and that's where the rest of the world begins. But you really look at it, is that's really hard to draw the lines there. You know, it's even true with emotion. When I'm feeling an emotion, is that I can go, yeah, this is what I'm feeling. But sometimes there's a lot of people in that room are feeling that too. It's hard to even draw the lines there with those things. So I can't quite often assign where those things are coming from, but it's more important to deal with it. When I go, well, that's theirs. If I leave, then, you know, I won't feel that anymore. It's more like, well, no, what's going on here? And then maybe something can be done about it. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Another thing.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thing that I noticed that when I spent a lot of time going to, you know, see a teacher like you.
Yeah.
and then you tell me things, and then I don't really do them.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
It's a funny thing.
Yeah, that's why I say the same thing over and over. but I was the same way with my Zumi Roshi until it clicked. You know, he would say things, and then eventually it clicked. Oh yeah, God, it took me 3 years to get that. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Even, you know, where you say appreciate your life almost every talk, you go, well, it's okay for you, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you're enlightened.
Right.
And then, but then it's just like, well, wait a minute. I do appreciate my life. You know, it doesn't have to be anything else. You know. Yeah. It's like, I think there's a more dramatic story of, I think it was the boat monk, who was practicing as a ferryman during the one of the pogroms that happened in China, and you know, apparently this monk realized it was the boat monk, and asked him, you know, what's the deepest meaning of living? And the boat monk grabbed him by the neck and put his head underwater and held it there for a while, and then he pulled it back up. Tell me, what's the most important thing about living? And then the guy goes, I'm breathing, and he had some realization at that point. But we get so tied up in it should be something else rather than what's imminent, you know. I mean, it's kind of harsh, but, you know, I mean, definitely you got the point, and that was the important part of it.
But the nice thing about that story is that...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, repetition. As human beings, that's what really gets us at some point. It's just like, you know, you do morning service, and there's things like the Heart Sutra. Things come out, and it begins to stick. Identity of relative and absolute, same thing. Things begin to stick. Even invocations like the Enmeijuku Kanongyo, is compassion then begins to stick. The dedications begin to come into your head, and then they appear in daily life. Not sort of written in that way, but the same things begin to come in. Oh, that's what they're talking about. You know, repetition, playing guitar, we become better at it. If you lose faith in that, you become worse at it, or you just, you know, stagnate, you forget stuff. That's how we learn. It should never be forgotten,
right?
on that level. That's why do Zazen every day, and then something mysterious happens. You know, we become present. Yeah.
Yep, yeah, being a guitar player, for me, whenever I lose the feeling of it, I just try to find, like, one note, you know?
Yeah.
I play one note that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
And when I feel separate or lost in my life, I the one note for me is just coming back to what's here and what's happening,
yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that's a wonderful place to start off, you know, because it's
all beings have the wisdom and virtue.
It's complete because it sounds good, like that little note, but it's also a good starting place too.
Yeah, no, it's
all
true.
Right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce. That's
how are we doing?
12:32.
So, if anybody else has something, we'll go into it, and if not, we will go into chat where we chat with each other.
Well, Alston, did you have a question, or did I accidentally unmute you?
You probably accidentally unmuted me, but I was just sitting here thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reminded somebody, I was listening to the talks.
It's a talking dog.
The podcast talks.
Yeah.
And somebody was saying, oh, you're listening to all these podcasts. What does he say? And I said, well, he kind of, in one sense, he says the same thing over and over again. And they said, well, why do you listen to him then? I said, well, because I need to hear it over and over again.
No, I agree. I mean, I was the same with my Zumi Roshi. He would say these things. It's just a reminder, you know. And again, that word reminder, it means he's bringing that back, that mind back to now, to this, you know, over and over.
Yeah. Well, that the next thing was that the reminder part. And I said, what surprises me is how I can forget what's important over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I have to remind myself over and over again.
And, you know, the Buddha actually said that, you know, a large part of practice is reminding oneself, you know. Yeah, so that's what we do. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks for the talk.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, having your dog there, I feel like I'm listening to a talking dog. But the thing is, he doesn't really change his expression. You got to get him to move a bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is, you know, the Zen part of that is he's really paying attention.
Right? Yeah, good. All right. I got it.
Thanks.
Thanks, Austin. Right. I think that's everything.
That is everything.
That's all of it. All right. I don't have any announcements. So, I think we'll just be back next Sunday, so we'll just open it up for chit-chat if anyone wants to say hello.
Yeah,
I'll move over.
Thank you very much for joining today.
Yeah, thank you.